Welcome to the Deep Dive. If you want a shortcut to being well-informed, this is where we extract the absolute best insights from, well, some pretty dense source material.
And today, we are definitely tackling a big one.
A really big one. We're cracking open the ultimate playbook on one of steel's most fascinating microstructures, bainite.
It's sort of the Goldilocks phase of steel, isn't it? It forms right between the really fast and the really slow transformations.
And for decades, it gave metallurgists a complete identity crisis.
Totally. Was it like martensite? You know, the stress-induced, almost instant shift?
Or was it more like perlite, a slow, patient process driven by carbon atoms moving around?
Bainite behaves like both. And figuring out that compromise is, I mean, it's absolutely key to creating modern, high-strength alloys.
So our source material for this is Gilbert R. Speich's definitive 1958 Doctor of Science thesis, The Growth of Bainite.
And our mission is pretty simple. We're going to stop just talking about the theories and get into the experimental proof Speech found.
The proof that finally reconciled this whole shear versus diffusion conflict.
And, you know, when you look at high-strength steel today, the properties you rely on, that toughness, that strength, it's all heavily influenced by how bainite formed. Speech's work gave engineers the playbook to finally control it.
All right, so let's unpack how he did it.
First, let's just establish where bainite fits into the whole picture.
Right, the context.
When you cool steel, you have different phases that transform based on temperature. Cool it slowly, you get high temperature stuff like perlite.
And if you cool it incredibly fast, like a quench.
You get low temperature phases like martensite. Bainite forms in those temperatures right in between the two extremes.
And it's not even just one single thing, right? There are different flavors of it.
Exactly. Even within that bainitic structure, you get two common forms, and it's mostly dictated by that formation temperature.
Okay, so let's start with the low temp one.
That's called lower bainite. It forms closer to the martensite start temperature, and under a microscope, it looks very dark and needle-like. Acicular is the technical term.
And it starts at the grain boundaries.
Yeah, it tends to nucleate in the grain boundaries, and then these needles grow inward.
Okay, so then what's the other form?
That would be upper bainite. It forms at slightly higher temperatures. People describe it as feathery-like, these soft, brush-like structures.
But it still starts at the boundaries.
Yes. It also nucleates to the boundaries, but it spreads out more broadly into the center of the grains.
But the real controversy, the thing that, you know, kept metallurgists arguing, wasn't what it looked like.
No, not at all. It was the choreography of the carbon. Where did the carbon atoms actually go when bainite was forming? Did they move before the structure shifted or after?
That sounds like a huge conceptual divide.
Oh, it was massive. On one side, you had researchers like Kriesmant and Weaver. They believed the carbon part precipitated within the austenite.
So in the original parent phase, before anything really changed.
Exactly. Like the ingredients are prepared first and then the main dish comes together.
And the other side of the argument.
The other camp, with people like Hultgren and Habrikan, they argued the complete opposite. They said the carbide precipitation happened within the ferrite itself.
The new structure.
The new structure, right at the interface where it was growing. That implies a mechanical, almost instantaneous change happens first, and the carbon atoms are just sort of kicked out afterwards.
So Speech set out to test all of this. He had to look at the history of these theories.
He did. First, you had Davenport and Bain back in the 30s. They just sort of guessed it was like martensite, and they even called it delayed martensite.
Then thermodynamics entered the picture.
Right, with Zener in 1946.
Yeah.
He suggested the whole thing was just driven by free energy, making it a math problem.
But the big theory he really had to confront was from Fischer in 1949, right?
Yes. Fischer's model was the one. Fischer suggested growth was controlled purely by the diffusion of carbon. Specifically, this local pileup of carbon right ahead of the growing ferrite plate.
A carbon traffic jam, basically.
That's a great way to put it. Fischer even claimed the carbon concentration in that tiny spot could be way higher than the average in the rest of the steel.
So you have all these conflicting ideas. Diffusion led, structure led, carbon pileup. Speech had to find a way to stop guessing.
Or watching.
You nailed it, watching. And that required a pretty revolutionary setup, especially for 1958.
It did. Speech's big innovation was this special hot stage microscope.
And that was the game changer.
Oh, absolutely. Before this, they could only look at the autoxy, the finished, cooled product. Speech's setup let him watch individual bainite plates growing in real time.
In situ, right on the sample surface while it was happening.
Exactly. The control was incredible. But to make sure they were only seeing bainite, They had to cool the sample down to that bainite formation temperature almost instantly.
From the really high austenitizing heat.
Yes, and to do that, they used a super powerful blast of helium to get an extremely rapid quench rate.
Why was that speed so critical?
Because it prevented perlite from forming. Perlite is slow and diffusive, and if any of that formed, it would just ruin the kinetic measurements they were trying to get.
So by watching continuously, they could finally measure something fundamental.
The exact length of a plate as a function of time. It completely overcame the limitations of all the earlier work.
And that first observation gave them a massive clue.
A huge one. Speech saw that the formation of a bainite plate was accompanied by something called surface upheaval.
Surface upheaval. So, to put it simply for you, the metal literally bulged up where the plate formed.
It literally rose up on the surface.
Wait a minute. If the metal bulged, that means there was a physical volume change, a strain.
Exactly.
And that's the classic fingerprint of a Martensitic or a shear transformation. The structure shifts without the atoms having time to diffuse.
Precisely. That was the first major piece of empirical evidence against the purely diffusion-based theories.
So to test this systematically, he used specific alloys.
Right. High-purity iron-based alloys. Some were pure iron carbon with different carbon amounts, and then he used more complex alloys with common additives.
Like chromium and nickel.
Yep. Yeah. They wanted to see exactly how each of these elements changed the speed and the mechanism.
Okay, so let's get into the hard data.
So when Speech actually analyzed the footage from the hot stage, the findings on the speed of growth were very, very clear.
What did he find?
He found that the growth rate of an individual bainite plate was constant. It was linear for the entire measurable length of the plate.
Linear growth. That's fast. If it was all just long-range carbon diffusion, wouldn't you expect the rate to slow down as the plate gets longer?
You absolutely would. The carbon would have to travel further and further.
So the fact that it was constant?
It was immediate support for the idea that the growth mechanism, at least at the start, was structural and fast, not purely diffusive and slow.
But the speed itself did depend on the temperature, right?
Oh, absolutely. They quantified that dependence using the Arrhenius equation. This analysis let them calculate the activation energy for the growth.
Activation energy. So that's like the size of the hurdle the atoms have to jump over to start the process.
That's a perfect analogy. And they calculated that hurdle height for every single alloy they tested.
So what were the big trends when they started changing the ingredients?
First, just looking at the pure iron carbon alloys, they found that simply increasing the carbon content drastically lowered the growth rates.
So more carbon means slower growth.
Much slower. Kinetically speaking, carbon is a massive inhibitor.
Okay, what about the alloying elements, the things we actually throw in to make steel better?
Adding either chromium or nickel also significantly, I mean markedly, reduced the bainitic growth rates compared to the pure iron carbon equivalent.
So adding complexity just slows everything down.
It does. But they didn't affect the transformation in exactly the same way.
How so?
Well, chromium tended to slightly raise that activation energy hurdle. It made it harder for the transformation to happen.
Okay, and nickel?
Nickel, on the other hand, tended to slightly lower the energy hurdle.
So it affects the process through a different mechanism.
It suggests that, yeah. The takeaway is that every little additive matters, and Speech finally had the quantitative data to show exactly how much.
All right, now we get to the microstructural reality.
And this is the core of that 40-year-long carbide controversy. Speech didn't just use the hot stage microscope. He combined it with electron microscopy and electron diffraction.
Which was a monumental technical leap from just looking at things with light.
Oh, it was everything. It let him analyze the carbide phase itself chemically and structurally. He could finally see where the carbon actually was.
So he could settle the debate. Which camp won?
The results were completely definitive. Speech found that regardless of the formation, temperature, high temp, upper bainite, or low temp, lower bainite, the carbide particles were always surrounded by a ferrite sheath.
A ferrite sheath, like a little protective wrapper?
Exactly like a wrapper. Imagine the growing ferrite plate is the main structure. The carbon atoms get kicked out, they immediately form the carbide, and that carbide is then contained entirely within that new ferrite wrapper.
And crucially.
Crucially, there was zero evidence of carbide forming in the parent austenite or at the growth interface. None.
Wow. So that settles it.
It settles it.
The structure has to shift first. That's the shear mechanism. And then the carbon atoms have to rush out and diffuse through the newly formed ferrite.
Precisely. He also confirmed the type of carbide changed with temperature. You got the normal, stable cementite at higher temps.
And at lower temps.
A more temporary metastable form called epsilon carbide.
So beyond the chemical proof, he also mapped the physical change in shape.
He did. And he found that the transition from that sharp, needle-like structure at low temps to the fuzzier high-temp structure was entirely gradual.
Not two different things, but a spectrum.
A continuous spectrum. At low temperatures, you get that clear, sharp, acicular shape. As you move up in temperature, the structure becomes much more nodular. It almost starts to look like a very fine version of perlite.
Did the alloy composition affect that shape very much?
Surprisingly little. He measured the ratio of plate length to width. And while that ratio dropped sharply with increasing temperature, meaning the plates got fatter when they formed hotter, it wasn't very sensitive to the alloy composition.
So temperature controls the shape way more than the carbon or the other additives.
Much more, yeah.
So Speech has all this definitive evidence now. He's got the linear growth rates.
Yep.
He's got the physical proof of that surface upheaval.
The bulging, right.
And then the smoking gun, the ferret sheet.
The absolute smoking gun.
Mm-hmm.
So he takes this mountain of data, and he just starts putting all the old theories to the test.
And how do they hold up?
Well, he confirmed that the predictions from the Chris Wiver theory, the one based on carbides forming in the austenite first, were just completely wrong.
Just didn't match the data?
Not even close.
But what about the Fisher growth model, the one about carbon diffusion?
That one agreed much better with his kinetic data.
So this brings us to the ultimate synthesis. This is the real nugget to take away.
It is. Speech had two undeniable facts in front of him. First, the visible surface upheaval means the lattice physically shears instantly, like martensite.
Fact number one.
And second, the definitive structure he saw, that ferret sheath, requires carbon to diffuse away and precipitate.
Which is a much slower process. So how do you reconcile a process that's near instantaneous with one that requires the slow movement of atoms?
He concluded that the growth of bainite is a sequential event.
Not one or the other.
Exactly. It starts diffusionless. An initial mechanical shearing of the lattice provides the structure and that fast growth, but that mechanical shift immediately triggers the carbon to be ejected and then diffuse through the newly formed ferret.
Ah. So it's not shear or diffusion, it's shear and then diffusion.
Shear and then diffusion. The lattice shifts, and then the carbon has to clean up the resulting mess.
So the Fisher model was right about the diffusion part, but it was just incomplete.
It was incomplete. It had to be modified to account for the actual physical strain and the surface upheaval that they saw directly under the microscope. Speech provided the unified theory.
So let's just let's wrap this up. What's the big takeaway here for you, the listener?
I mean, it's that Speech's work in 58 was just, it was a monumental leap forward.
It really was. It took the whole field from this state of, you know, conflicting conceptual guesswork.
To a single experimentally proven mechanism.
Yeah.
He showed us that the physical form of bainite comes from that initial fast mechanical shear.
And the final structure, the strong, useful thing we want.
That comes from the necessary subsequent carbon diffusion.
It really is the ultimate example of material science providing the clarity that engineering needs to take control.
Absolutely.
But here's a thought that still keeps researchers in the field busy today. Even though Speech confirmed the structure and the sequence, the precise mechanism that explains that continuous shearing motion, the thing that drives the initial transformation, that remained, and this is in his own words, the main stumbling block of most theories.
Which raises a really profound question. If the mechanical shear provides the drive and diffusion provides the energy release, what is the precise physical interplay between that pure mechanical strain and the thermodynamics of diffusion?
We know they happen in sequence, but what actually sustains that incredibly rapid motion?
The physics of that exact moment of transformation are still just incredibly complex.